wanna say love, but you're my blood. Tell me, is this where I give it all up for you? I have to risk it all, 'cause the writing's on the wall.
So, Film Bookcast audience, do you expect us to talk? We hope you do, because this is a podcast, and if we don't, it's just a bunch of weird silence for the next 60 to 90 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, it could go either way.
You don't need that, but you do need Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me is a man who is the author of All My Pain.
Mike DiCriccio.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good, good, I'm excited. Sorry about all the pain, but...
Yeah, I'm glad, I mean, you got a book out of it.
Yeah, so it kind of worked out in the long run.
So if you've never listened to an episode of Film Bookcast before, essentially what we do is we start off with some film news and then move on to our discussions for the week. Mike's got a few movies, I've got a few movies. And then after that, we will move on to our featured review. This week, we are reviewing the 24th movie in the James Bond franchise, Spectre, directed by Sam Mendes and starring Daniel Craig in his fourth film as the character. Are you excited, Mike?
Yeah, yeah. I'm always fun when Bond... It's always fun when Bond movies come out.
Yeah, you're always fun when Bond movies come out.
I am also... I reserve my fun for Bond movies.
Don't sell yourself short on on your own fun.
Thanks, Mike.
But we'll get to that in a bit. But first, let's start off with some film news, Mike.
Okay, that's usually what we do.
Exactly, so why don't we do that?
All right, moving on.
All right, so there's a few things of film news this week. The first and the biggest film news, I thought, it's actually more TV news, but bear with me. Star Trek is coming out with a new TV show starting in January 2017.
Yeah, yeah, that's awesome. I'm excited for that. That'll be cool.
Yeah, that's, but... That's something that people have been asking for a long time. Like since Star Trek's gotten bigger as the popular consciousness, people have been like, "When's the TV show coming out?" Because a lot of people prefer the TV shows to the movies.
Yeah, now that the nerds have taken over.
Yeah, it was only
another one.
It was only a matter of time, and I'm curious how the show's going to be. Like, what the content that's going to be like. Like, I'm sure it's not going to involve the crew from the movies. Like,
no, that'd be silly. Although that might be cool.
That would be kind of nuts if they could rope in like Chris Pine and Zoe Saldana and like to get them to do a TV show that will not be on television.
Yeah, that's apparently the only thing that makes me think this is going to be, I don't know about weird, but it won't be like big, awesome.
Yeah, it's, like, so the way this is working is that they're coming out with a new Star Trek TV show. It's going to be on CBS Access, which is going to be CBS's streaming service.
Yes.
That you'll have to pay a monthly fee for. Mm-hmm. And it won't be airing on CBS, as far as I know. I think the first episode will air on CBS as like sort of like an ad for the site or for the service. But after that, every episode is just going to be on that streaming service.
Yep.
And that's a gamble.
Yeah, that's a bold move. It also kind of worries me. I don't know if it worries me, but in some weird way, we're going to move towards like the stratification of cable networks now, where like you got to pay per channel. Instead of, like, pay for cable and you get all of these channels.
Right.
I mean, you have to pay for premium stuff now anyway.
Yeah.
But am I going to have to pay $5 a month per network? Is that what's going to happen now?
That's what it sort of seems like it's moving towards. Like, I know NBC is developing their own streaming service as well, coming out, I think, this January, called CISO. And that's going to have a new show. Like, that's going to have access to most of their streaming library, like 30 Rock and The Office. It's also going to have new shows from Amy Poehler and from Dan Harmon. And so, you know, that sounds exciting, and it's going to cost about like $6 a month or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be pretty, I'd be kind of okay with it if it works in a, network or Netflix type fashion where like I pay for the CBS library and then I get just, you know, access to all of the old shows that have been on, you know, and all the new stuff.
Yes. So but, I mean, that's kinda cool. How many CBS shows are you planning to watch?
Well, on principle, Mike, not CBS in general, but if it's not like. If it's not, I'm paying $5 a month to watch one episode per week again. If I can get, like, all of the shows.
Yes. Yeah, okay. Fair enough. So it's a gamble. Like, I think, you know, I think most people would prefer for the show to just be on TV.
Yeah, let's be real. Most people are probably going to just torrent it anyway. So,
yeah, probably. And CBS, like this is going to be their flagship show. Like going forward, this is going to launch that site.
Yeah, although it is a good series to pick to get the Absolutely, most people yeah. involved in.
And so, there's
Thank
that.
Thank God it's not Big Bang Theory season 14 or whatever the hell they're on.
Yeah, they're pretty far into that. in any case, Star Trek TV show. Alex Kurtzman's also going to be involved with the show. And Alex Kurtzman co-wrote both of J.J. Abrams' movies with Roberta Orci. He's also the co-writer of films such as Transformers Revenge of the Fallen, Cowboys and Aliens, and the Cinematic Amazing Spider-Man 2. So, I mean, he's the backbone
of the industry.
Yeah, he's also an executive producer on some TV shows, some of which have turned out good. He's an executive producer on Fringe.
Right.
So there's that as well.
So there's that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's got talent involved in it, so that's cool.
Yeah, I feel like it's more like he's involved as a producer, but it's going to be like – he might be like picking who's actually going to be running the show, you know?
Right, right.
So it's very up in the air right now. All we know is that there's going to be a new Star Trek show. We don't know anything about who's in it,
what
characters it's going to focus on, what it's about, or who is actually making the show other than Alex Kurtzman being involved as an executive producer.
So there you go.
So film that's news. Our news for the day.
Yeah, film news.
We don't know anything about this thing, but it's happening.
But we're going to talk about it.
And speaking of,
yes.
Next bit of film news, I'm not sure if this is actually confirmed yet or not, but there's a rumor going around that an all-female remake of Ocean's 11 is going to be happening, starring Sandra Bullock in the lead role.
Okay.
Yeah, well, that's...
That's neat.
And that'll be directed by Gary Ross, who directed the first Hunger Games movie and also directed films like Pleasantville and Seabiscuit.
Okay. Tobey Maguire will be in this.
I mean, don't you think the Hunger Games would be a much better movie if Tobey Maguire was there in some capacity?
Yes, done.
Right?
I wish he was Donald Sutherland's role. Yes. He was the president. Because then he'd be sort of likable also. And I'd be conflicted about it.
Right. Because he'd be like, oh, you're a jerk, but you're Spider-Man.
But you're Spider-Man also. Now, do we know... I know this is a completely unfounded rumor, but is it going to be Ocean's 11 girl edition, like Ghostbusters, or is it going to be just that type of movie?
It sounds like Ocean's 11 girl edition, like Ghostbusters. Which is odd that this is, like, a trend now. Like...
Yeah, I mean, it's great that, like, female, like, this is happening for female actresses, like, for actresses and stuff, but,
yeah.
I want this to happen through original work, although maybe that's a sign that it can't happen, that they have to take...
They have to take existing properties.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Because Hollywood is such an asshole, because it's a person now that I've invented.
Right, Mr. Hollywood.
Mr. Hollywood is a dick.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, it's a little weird, but it's, you know, an interesting concept. I like the idea. I think Sandra Bullock could be good in the lead role. I have a weird relationship with Sandra Bullock movies because I don't like 90% of them, but I think she's very good.
Yeah,
in most
she's great. What fall into the 10% that you do like?
I like Gravity.
Okay.
I like Speed.
Yes, done.
I thought The Heat was okay.
I actually never saw The Heat.
Yeah, that's pretty much the end of the list.
Like, okay, fair enough.
Like, I really hated The Blind Side.
I never even saw that.
Yeah, it's pretty rough. And I've, like, I don't know, most of, like, I don't know. Like, she's made good movies.
Right.
I'm sure there's movies.
She's not a bad actress, just the movies are bad.
I'm sure there's movies of hers that I haven't seen that I would like.
Right.
But of what I've seen, like, I really only care for, I really only really like Gravity and Speed.
I love that Speed is in the list, yes. Oh, that's so good.
Me. I do think it's funny. Are you familiar with John Mulaney at all, the comedian?
Yes.
Yeah, he has a bit where he's a bit in his stand-up where he says, like, you could never do an Ocean's 11 remake that was all women.
Really? Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Like, because, and he says it's because two would break off to go talk shit about the other nine. Like, every 5 minutes.
Yep.
Or just say really passive-aggressive things to each other.
That's amazing.
It's a pretty funny bit, if you haven't seen it. Recommended. That's on John Mulaney, New in Town. It's available on Netflix.
Nice plug. All right. What's our next completely unfounded news story that we're going to talk about?
Oh, this isn't unfounded. This actually seems like it's happening.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. So Neil Blomkamp's Alien movie, mm-hmm. which we've talked about a lot in the past. Remember when we were reviewing Chappie, that was like kind of a big discussion point for us.
Yes.
So Neil Blomkamp was going to be directing an Alien sequel. It would have been quote-unquote Alien 5, mm-hmm. although there's been like Alien vs. Predator and Prometheus, a bunch of different stuff.
They don't count.
Alien 5 was going to be Neil Blomkamp's movie. It would have been his next movie, but it has now been put on hold in favor of Ridley Scott's Prometheus sequel, which is currently titled Alien Paradise Lost.
Okay.
So
R.I.P. Neil Blomkamp's career.
Yeah, it's a little, you know, I was hoping for something big out of him because, like, District 9 was great.
Yeah.
I love District 9. And we've talked about this before. Alicia was really disappointing. And Chappie, I think we both walked out of that theater kind of like, all right, that was okay. Like,
yeah.
But a lot of people really hated that movie.
Yeah, they did.
Spoiler alert, that's kind of what we thought of Spectre.
Yeah. Whoa, it's kinda... easy. but yeah, I felt like he's approaching the end of the goodwill of District 9. Like, yeah. People were kind of like, all right, make another, like, you got to make a good one now. And this could have been it. But, I mean, is it, like, canned? Like, it's done? They're not going to do it? Or is it just postponed?
I don't think it's kind of up in the air at the moment right now. I think, Neil Blomkamp wants to make the movie. And
right.
Like, the whole reason the movie is being made is because, like, 20th Century Fox basically just came up to him and said, like, hey, can you make one? Like,
right. So that's a good point.
and so now it's been put on hold because of Prometheus 2,
mm-hmm.
Which, like, Ridley Scott's in a very good place right now. He just made The Martian.
Yeah.
You know, which is his best movie in, like, 30 years. So, you know, that's kind of cool. Like, I'm excited for Prometheus 2. I thought Prometheus 1 was pretty good.
Yeah, I enjoyed Prometheus.
So I'm eager to see that, and I think that I want to see more of Ridley Scott's visual eye coming in forth in Prometheus sequels. I thought his Prometheus 1 looks amazing.
Yeah.
But the original plan was for, I think, Prometheus 2 to come out, and then for Neil Blomkamp's Alien 5 to come out. But now I think it might be deemed too confusing that there's two different Alien movies coming out within, like, a year of each other.
Right.
That take place entirely in different...
different time periods.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess that would be the case, but do they really think that people are that dumb that they can't they can't figure out which movie is, like, about what?
I mean, I think also part of the problem is that Ridley Scott's calling his movie Alien: Paradise Lost.
Right. If it had a different title, they
probably... If it was called Prometheus Paradise Lost, like, I feel like it'd be fine. Right. It sort of almost feels like a power play.
Oh, yeah. Wow, I never even thought of that. You're right.
And maybe I'm just making that up, but, like, it's...
Well, we can run with that. It's fine.
You know, maybe, like, Ridley Scott doesn't want Neil Blomkamp to make his movie or whatever. I don't know.
Maybe. Weird.
But anyway, that's our film news for the week.
All right.
So I guess we should move on to our discussion. So, Mike, you have 3 movies to talk about, and I have 3 movies to talk about.
Yeah.
So how about we go, like, one by one?
Oh, okay. I like that.
All right.
Let's change it up a bit.
So why don't you go first? Your trilogy of films.
The one last trilogy. I figured for episode 20, this is our 20th episode of Film Bookcast.
Yes, it is. Happy anniversary.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
I didn't get you anything.
I just need you is all I need. I figured, you know, for our 20th episode, I might as well rip off my film book mask and expose myself, or my film buff mask, excuse me, and expose myself as a fraud.
Okay.
This week I'm doing movies I'm embarrassed to have seen for the first time this past weekend.
All right.
So number one is Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah, you should be embarrassed. Yeah,
don't you shake your head at me, Mike.
I'm shaking my head and I'm wagging my finger.
Yeah, you are. I just need the tip of the cap now. Yeah, I don't know. It was one of these movies that I think all 3 of these movies are kind of things I was like, yeah, no, I've seen that before. And then I was like, wait, no, I haven't. And I read that book I've talked about, Shock Value. I've talked about that a couple times on the podcast. There's a whole chapter on Rosemary's Baby, and it was like, this is amazing. I need to actually see this now. And it was on Netflix, and I watched it, and I'm better for it. I'm a better person. I feel like my reference points for movies now have grown.
There you go. Yeah. It's been probably like 6 years since I've watched Rosemary's Baby. So I'm a little, like, what I remember about it the most is that it takes a really long time to get to where it's going, but it's really fascinating, even despite that. Like,
yeah, it's one of those things. It's like, you know, what my favorite kinds of horror movies, I guess, where they're not scary per se. It's just like weird. It's just off-putting.
Right.
And like, I feel gross watching it, and like, not much is happening. No, like, nothing's even happening. Like, it's just like, it's just creepy. Like, with the weird neighbors, and that's it. That's all it takes for me to feel unsettled in this movie.
Right.
And then it gets to where it's going, and it's like, oh no, this is all real. This is all like super serious take on what is happening.
Yep.
And it was great. So what's your first movie, Mike?
All right. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed Rosemary's Baby, Mike. My first movie, all of my movies are a trilogy of movies.
Mm-hmm.
Much like you have a trilogy of movies that you're embarrassed not seen before, I have a trilogy of movies that we could have reviewed for this podcast, but they all came out at the same time.
Right. All on the same weekend, I think.
So we ended up going Bridge of Spies last time, but all these movies came out around the same time, and we didn't get a chance to review them, but I got to see them all anyway, so I'm going to talk about them here. My first movie is Steve Jobs, the new film by Danny Boyle and Aaron Sorkin.
Mm-hmm.
That stars Michael Fassbender, Kate Winslet, Seth Rogen, and Jeff Daniels, among several others. Michael Stuhlbarg as well. I really enjoyed Steve Jobs. I thought it was a really dynamic movie. Aaron Sorkin's script is terrific. All the performances are amazing. Michael Fassbender is terrific in the role. And it's crazy because, you know, there was another Jobs movie that came out a couple years ago with Ashton Kutcher as Steve Jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And that movie, it's weird because you can watch that movie and this movie back to back, and you can tell that movie was made because Ashton Kutcher looks a lot like Steve Jobs.
Right, 100%.
But this movie was made because Michael Fassbender is actually a good actor.
Like, wow, burn. But yeah.
This movie was in development for a long time. There's a lot of it had a very difficult process because David Fincher was supposed to direct it at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And dropped out, and the actor who played Steve Jobs changed a bunch of times. Christian Bale was supposed to be it at one point.
Right, yeah, I do remember that.
But it's ended up now with Danny Boyle directing, Aaron Sorkin's script, with Michael Fassbender as Jobs. And I think it turned out great. I was always excited for an Aaron Sorkin, Steve Jobs movie, because that just seemed like a great... Like, I'm a big fan of Aaron Sorkin's work, and I think he was a good fit for that kind of story. And the structure of the movie is really interesting. It takes place over three conferences.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, there's, like, three acts of the movie, and each one is just, like, a really long scene, basically,
right?
Of him at like a conference for a new product launch,
right?
And it's really interesting. You get a really good sense of who Steve Jobs was, and there's a lot of great Sorkinisms as well. Danny Boyle is pretty solid as a director here. I'm always like hit or miss with Danny Boyle, but I think he does a really good job here. The ending of this movie is terrible.
Yeah, from what you told me, yes.
Yeah, the ending is really rough, but everything leading up to that is so good. Like it pretty much, like, the ending doesn't ruin it.
Yeah.
So definitely Steve Jobs, worth checking out. Big fan.
I think that structure of three keynote addresses as, like, the different points in his life, I think that's really interesting, and I definitely want to see this. I guess I'll wait till – I mean, it's still in theaters, but –
Right.
I'll probably just wait.
Yeah, I mean, it did disappointing box office, but it is still in theaters for the time being. So definitely, if you can check it out, go for it. And one like little side note, there's so I'm a big fan of The Simpsons.
who knew?
As I've mentioned a few times before, and there's a transition in this movie. Between Act 2 and 3, it's after Steve Jobs has been like fired from Apple.
Right.
And there's a transition where you see him coming back to Apple. Like, it kind of goes through this whole thing. And you see the reason is because Apple released the Newton, which was this like handheld device that came out in the 90s that flopped big time. And as soon as they mentioned the Newton, my mind went directly to a Simpsons reference to the Newton. Because it's the only thing I associated with the Newton. And it's
I've never even heard of the Newton until you told me.
Because it was a huge disaster.
Yeah.
But in The Simpsons, there's an episode where... Martin does something dorky and the bullies are like, Dolph, take a memo on your Newton. and he writes it on the Newton, beat up Martin. And it, like, the Newton mistranslates it to eat up Martha. And so Kearney, like, takes it and goes, bah, and tosses it and it hits Martin on the head.
Classic Simpsons.
Yeah. And that's exactly like that whole scene played in my head the second they mentioned the Newton.
Yep.
And then as soon as it finished playing in my head, they played that scene in the movie.
You're a prophet, Mike.
Yeah, it was pretty great. So
So you're a screenwriter just like Aaron Sorkin, then.
Pretty much, yep. So if you're a fan of The Simpsons or a fan of The Newton...
There you go. This has a thing for you.
Yeah. All right, so you have another movie you want to talk about, Mike?
Yeah, so the second movie I'm embarrassed to admit that I saw for the first time this weekend is The Conversation. So our other podcast, The Complete Works, we've been doing Nicolas Cage things, and we had a run of Francis Ford Coppola movies.
Yeah, that's true.
And we've constantly talked about how he made the three best movies of all time in the 70s. And
Godfather, Conversation, and Apocalypse Now, and Godfather Part 2.
And Godfather Part 2, you're right. So I was like, I've never seen one of those movies.
You've never seen...
Conversation.
Okay.
Yeah.
For a second, you're like, I've never seen one of those movies, as if, like...
Oh, no.
You haven't seen any of them, which is,
no,
like,
I've seen,
ridiculous.
I have seen three of the four. Let me rephrase that there. Yeah. So I was derping around on Netflix, and I don't know if Conversation had been on there in a while, but
it's been on there for a while, yeah.
For a while. Well, I saw it. It was on the front page or home, whatever. It popped up as a recommendation I was deemed worthy by the Netflix algorithm to see this movie. So I decided to watch it yesterday, actually. And you were right. It's one of the four best movies of all time. I don't know. It was awesome. It was really good. I liked it. I enjoyed it a lot. It reminded me a lot of The Lives of Others. I don't know if you've seen that.
I have not.
It was a German film about the Stasi in East Berlin. Okay. And it won the best foreign language film in 2006 or something like that. I looked it up. I think that's what it was.
Okay.
About a guy who's works for the Stasi, the secret police of East Berlin. And he has to listen to, surveil a couple about, their anti-communist or communist ways and stuff. And it's sort of the same kind of thing. Like, does he get involved? And
right.
That type of thing. But the conversation's awesome. It just reminded me how great Gene Hackman is. I haven't seen him in anything in a long time.
Yeah.
Or
I mean,
any of his movies.
Yeah. Well, he is retired. So,
right. Well, yeah. I meant I haven't watched a movie with him in it in a long time. So I just forgot that he's the coolest.
Yeah. Yeah. He's terrific.
Yeah. And it made me appreciate or realize Rumblefish also, which is another Francis Ford Coppola movie we did.
Right.
Or maybe realize that sound design has been super important to Francis Ford Coppola for all of his movies, apparently, which I never really picked up on.
Yeah.
That's in Rumble. That's the whole point of Rumblefish, basically.
Yeah, Rumblefish is a lot of really great sound design.
Yeah. So maybe it's just a thing that I'm noticing more now. But
as you're becoming a...
Yeah, as I'm slowly putting the mask of film buff back on. Yeah, so that's my second movie.
Okay. So my second movie that we could have reviewed, but just didn't have the time to, Crimson Peak, which is the new movie from director Guillermo del Toro.
Yes.
And stars Mia Wasikowska, Tom Hiddleston, Jessica Chastain, Charlie Hunnam. And it's pretty solid.
And it's good?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I was hoping for more out of it because I love Guillermo del Toro. I think that cast is really good. And I love the premise and the idea behind this movie. It's like this gothic romance that happens. It's like a haunted house story that Guillermo del Toro is making. And it's really, as far as that goes, I think that's a really cool idea. And I think Guillermo del Toro could knock that out of the park. Mm-hmm. The movie turns out it has some issues, but when it's working, it's really great.
That's good.
At its best, it's this big, bold, beautiful film. It looks amazing. It's gorgeous to look at. And, it has long stretches of time where there's I don't know. I just wasn't that into it.
Okay. And are those the horror stretches or the romance stretches?
Well, that's the thing. I think they both work individually on their own.
Okay.
And the ghosts are mostly used as a metaphor, throughout the film.
Right.
I think they work well on their own, but I think the movie could have done without the ghosts.
Okay. So you think it would have been better if it was that horror stuff wasn't there at all?
Not necessarily that there wouldn't be horror stuff. I feel like there could be.
Right.
Because there's, as the movie's going on, you start to learn about the sinister plot that Jessica Chastain is brewing.
Right.
And so you have this tense plot already there with those three characters, Mia Wasikowska, Tom Hiddleston, and Jessica Chastain.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really need the ghosts.
Okay, I see.
You know what I mean?
That makes sense.
The ghosts make for some great imagery, and there's a lot of really great scenes with the ghosts in them.
Right.
But I feel like overall, the movie would be a lot better, like if it was just a straight like thriller set in this house.
Okay. Fair enough.
But like I said, the movie is very good, and the performances. Tom Hiddleston's great in this movie. Yes. You know, he's kind of doing Loki, but like a more like Loki's very charming. You know.
Yeah.
Like he's kind of doing that.
Okay, that's cool.
But it's
so he's just being Tom Hiddleston, I assume.
Kind of, yeah. But he's good. And Charlie Hunnam's in this movie also, which has not really been in many of the trailers. But I think it's he's kind of like the sort of hero. He's delegated to a relatively minor role overall, but mm-hmm. he's kind of like the good guy
in this movie.
And I think it's funny that Guillermo del Toro is just really trying to make America love Charlie Hunnam.
yeah, he is.
After this in Pacific Rim. So, you know, I did enjoy this movie. It's not one of my favorite Guillermo del Toro films, but it's a very solid time.
All right.
And it's very unique. I think there's not that many movies coming out that are like Crimson Peak.
Yeah, that's the thing that I haven't seen this yet, but that's one of the, that's a draw for me, too, is that it's Guillermo del Toro, one, doing something really unique and pretty, it looks like.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's cool.
Yep. So what was your third movie, Mike?
All right, so the third movie that I'm embarrassed to admit that I saw for the first time this weekend is Big Trouble in Little China.
Okay.
So this one I had seen parts of. I had seen, like, at a party, like, my friend, we were hanging out at my friend's house, and he put it on, but, like, I wasn't really paying attention to it. But, so I was flipping through the channels, and I saw it on TV, on a movie channel that I had never found before. So it's actually the full unedited, not, very like, cool. TNT or whatever, because I don't think that counts as seeing a movie.
Fair enough. Neither do I.
Good. And I'm glad I did. This was another one of those, like, it was awesome. I watched it with my parents, actually.
Yeah.
And they were like, I think I remember, like, this, like, not being good. And I was like, you're wrong. Stop. But then they were like, oh, you're right. This is, like, a cult movie, isn't it? I was like, I guess. I don't know. I don't really know.
Yeah. I mean, it basically is.
Basically is, yeah. And it's just one of those, like, silly, over-the-top action movies. I mean, not even over-the-top, but, like, just goofy in a fun way. Yeah. I feel like when I do these discussions about old movies that we've saw, or, like, when I did Twin Peaks, that, like, everyone knows what this is. I don't really need to talk about it a whole lot.
Right. I mean, we did talk about Big Trouble in Little China a little while ago in one of our reviews because they announced the remake of the movie.
Right. Yeah, there you go. That's right.
And so I had actually watched it around the time they announced that remake just because I wanted mm-hmm. to, like, just because I wanted to see, like, if it would work as a remake.
I'm not sure it can.
Exactly.
Because, like, it's kind of super racist.
There is that.
Yeah. I mean, that was okay for, like, an 80s cult movie. And, like, I get it's, like, tongue-in-cheek poking fun of those stereotypes anyway.
Right.
But, like, for a modern audience, I don't think they'd be okay with that.
Yeah, it's weird. And I don't, like, the remake would star The Rock as Kurt Russell. But really, the hero of the movie is his sidekick.
Wang or Wayne, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm blanking on his name as well, but like Kurt Russell's sidekick in the movie is actually like the real hero. Like the movie is his.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
The movie's about him.
Yeah. I mean, they take the potion from Egg, I think was his name.
Right.
the like bus driver guy, and he's like, oh, if you're a hero, you'll be able to take this and give you superpowers. And Kurt Russell doesn't get superpowers.
Right.
So he's clearly not the hero of the movie.
Yeah. He's kind of just the guy who like helps out. Like he kind of just gets dragged into all this.
He's the guy who stumbles into this story.
Yeah. And I feel like a remake, with The Rock, you know, I feel like it would just focus on The Rock.
Right. He would be the hero.
He would be the hero, which would kind of lose, you know, sort of the appeal of that movie, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a great, it's got the great practical effects of John Carpenter.
Yes.
Like, there's a lot of that. I wasn't ready for expecting that.
Yeah, John Carpenter's all over that movie, too. You know, he did the, he also recorded the song at the end of the movie.
Really?
The Big Trouble in Little China theme song.
That's awesome.
Big Trouble!
Yeah.
In Little China!
That's so great. I didn't know that was him.
Yeah.
But yeah, it also has, since reading Shock Value, they talk about in Halloween the you know John Carpenter's score for that movie, and I mean his scores for all of his movies are awesome, but this I felt Big Trouble in Little China has a very similar like driving just kind of like ominous score in the background throughout almost the whole movie.
Right.
Sort of like Halloween has it, but not as iconic or creepy as Halloween, obviously.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. That was cool.
Yeah.
So those are the three movies that I'm embarrassed to admit I saw for the first time this weekend.
Okay. And you were a fan of all of them from what
all I three. Yeah. All three were great. I'm a better person for it.
Exactly. All right. And the last movie I want to talk about, is the new movie by Robert Zemeckis, The Walk, which stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt as, Philippe Petit, who is, the guy who walked on the World Trade Center on a wire back in the '70s.
Yes.
And this has already been made into a movie, back in 2004. There's a documentary called Man on Wire, which, is very, like, it tells basically the entire story that this movie tells.
Right.
But there was no filmed footage of him on the wire. There are still photos, but there's no, like, actual video of it. And, so Zemeckis' desire to make this movie was so that there would be some kind of, like, video record of, even if it's fictionalized, like nobody's ever seen him do it
right
live, except for the people who were there, and, you know, could see it from 100 floors below.
right.
And I gotta say, I loved this movie.
Really?
I really loved it.
I'm surprised. Most people did not. It seems.
Yeah, it seems like most reviews were kind of lukewarm. Like, people seem to like it, but there was there's this, I don't know. I think it builds, like, it's, for the most part of the movie, it builds up to The Walk, you know? Like,
right.
Everything up to that is leading up to it, and it's very solid up to that point. There's a lot of really good stuff in there. You know, there's sort of like this heist film sort of stuff going on in the middle of it, because they have to figure out how to get into the World Trade Center and how to, you know, get all their people into, and it's like this whole gang that they assemble. And that's really fun.
Okay.
But ultimately, the movie is about, you know, following your dreams, making things happen. It is. Like, that's...
Yeah, I believe it.
It's about art and about how, like, you know, it's really kind of incredible. It's very earnest.
Right.
It feels like it's, you know, very honest, and it's very earnest that it, like, people like to tear that stuff down a lot.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I feel like it wears its heart on its sleeve, and it's better for it. And the walk itself looks amazing. Like, it looks great. Like, it's... You know, you're watching it, and you know, like, intellectually, that there's no possible way that this is not entirely CGI.
Right.
Right, because A, the Twin Towers aren't there anymore, so it's not like they can film there. And B, like, you know they weren't going to do that anyway, even if they were.
No, absolutely.
You know, and, I've seen photos of Joseph Gordon-Levitt on the wire, like, filming that scene.
Yeah.
And he's maybe, like, 6 feet above the ground, like, at most.
Right. Right.
But, you know, the movie, just visually, it looks great, and the, like, sound design and the score, it all works together to create, like, this really incredible, experience. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt's great as Philippe Petit, I think. A lot of people took issue with his accent, but I think he sounds fine. Like, he sounds like Philippe Petit. Like, and it sounds weird coming out of Joseph Gordon-Levitt, but it does sound right if you consider the character.
All right, there you go.
And the movie does have some... They have a sort of tribute to September 11th as well.
I would assume.
Right. Like, they don't directly acknowledge it, but they do it in, like, an interesting way, which is very good. I think it works very well.
That's pretty cool.
And it's a movie that I really liked, and it took me on a fun ride. And if we made a top 10 list for this year, which we might...
Right.
We might do a film book cast of our top 10. The Walk would probably be online.
Really? All right. That's cool. I like that.
So there is that. So I guess that wraps up our discussions, Mike.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
All right.
I'm thoroughly embarrassed, so we can move on.
All right. So why don't we do that? Let us move on into our featured review of Spectre.
This organization... Do you know what it's called?
Its name is Spectre.
Look around you, James. Everything you believed in, a ruin. Why did you come? I came here to kill you.
Yeah.
you came here to die.
Well, it's all a matter of perspective.
That was from the trailer for Spectre. It is the newest film in the official James Bond franchise, the 24th of the official James Bond franchise. That does not include films like Never Say Never Again or 1967's Casino Royale.
Right, right.
This is the Eon Productions James Bond franchise. This is directed by Sam Mendes, who directed the last movie in the franchise, Skyfall, also directed films like American Beauty and Road to Perdition, and written by John Logan, Neil Purvis, Robert Wade, and Jez Butterworth. The film stars Daniel Craig as James Bond for the fourth time. It also stars Christoph Waltz, Lea Seydoux, Ben Whishaw, Naomi Harris, Ralph Fiennes, Dave Bautista, Monica Bellucci, and many more. The IMDb plot synopsis of Spectre reads, "A cryptic message from Bond's past sends him on a trail to uncover a sinister organization. While M battles political forces to keep the Secret Service alive, Bond peels back the layers of deceit to reveal the terrible truth behind Spectre."
Wow. IMDb stepping up their game.
Yeah, right?
Out of control.
Exactly. So there's a lot of big expectations for Spectre coming into this movie after Skyfall, which was universally acclaimed. Like, everybody loved Skyfall. That's a movie with, like, I think a 90% of Rotten Tomatoes. It made over $1 billion at the box office, and everybody was just a huge fan. And that was particularly special because that was the 50th anniversary of Bond when that came out.
Right.
And so after Skyfall, they brought back Sam Mendes, who directed Skyfall. Daniel Craig's back again. So I think after that movie, there was huge expectations coming into this.
Oh, yeah.
And not only that, but they set themselves up with Spectre, which is the organization that is behind a lot of the classic Bond films. Most of the ones with Sean Connery have to deal with Spectre. But they haven't been in a movie since the Connery days.
Right.
And so, in addition to the universally expectations set up by Skyfall, you have expectations from fans who are wanting, who like, with Spectre now. So, do you think they set themselves up to fail a little bit? Like,
I think so, maybe a little bit, but I don't remember exactly. Wasn't there, like, big delays with this also? Or I don't remember.
Maybe, I don't know. It's only been 3 years since Skyfall. Which is about right, I feel like.
Yeah, that's not bad. I don't know what I'm thinking of then. But weird. But yeah, they kind of with the way Skyfall ended in the, like, kind of reference, it, the sort of reboot kind of thing they got going on, there's a lot of hype with that and, like, you know, big Bond return to form kind of movie.
Sure.
Because Quantum of Solace and Casino Royale were such a departure from the type of movies. I feel like they couldn't have met those expectations.
Yeah, it was a lot of huge thoughts coming into this.
Yeah.
And so I guess, but ultimately, I guess what I'm saying is that the reception to Spectre has not been as good as Skyfall was. You know, I think on Rotten Tomatoes it's at something like a 60 something, which is still fresh, but it's not, you know, as fresh as Skyfall was.
Yeah.
You know, Scott Mendelson from Forbes, he's a really solid critic, and he's a really good box office pundit. His review headline was that Spectre is the worst 007 movie in 30 years.
Wow. Really?
That's what he said.
Damn.
And he says, "Poorly mixing nostalgia and newfangled, it's all connected franchise world building, the stitched together Spectre will bore the living daylights out of you while threatening to render James Bond a culturally irrelevant relic of the past."
Wow.
Like, that's harsh.
That is very harsh.
That's really harsh. And it's not the only review out there that is saying, like, this movie's really rough.
Yeah,
I've seen a lot of reviews saying that. And actually, we're both big fans of the Slash Filmcast. Every member of the Slash Filmcast hated Spectre.
Really? I haven't listened to that episode yet.
They haven't released the episode yet, but I've seen them on Twitter, and, like, DaVinci Hardware, and Jeff Cannata were all not fans of the movie.
Oh, man. Jeff Cannata, I trusted you.
But with that all said, Mike, what did you think of Spectre?
It didn't suck. I don't know.
Yeah, I actually thought Spectre was pretty good.
Yeah, I had fun. It was good. I do see the I do understand the kind of like burnout that people are talking about with these with this movie, like the kind of old hat type thing.
Sure. I mean, it's again, like, I feel like expectations after Skyfall were so high.
Yeah.
I'm not sure Spectre could have possibly met them. And I think Spectre is a much more flawed film than Skyfall is. So I definitely could see people saying it's not as good. I don't understand how you could say something like it's the worst Bond movie in 30 years. When Quantum of Solace is right there.
Yeah, I was just saying, what about the What's It of Boris?
Yeah, Quantum of Solace or Die Another Day is also, like, really bad. I was actually, before we were doing this before we were recording this episode, I was revisiting a lot of the Bond themes.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, Die Another Day is not a good film. But,
yeah. But it's got the invisible car.
It does have the invisible car. But the thing is with Die Another Day, the second the opening credits starts, you can tell, like, man, this movie's going to suck. Because Madonna's Die Another Day theme is, like, one of the worst songs, like, ever recorded. Like, it's...
Wow. It's not even Bond themes, just songs.
Yeah, it's just songs in general. It's so bad. Like, like you're watching it and
I haven't listened to that in a long time.
Do you remember what that song is like? Like,
no, I don't.
Oh, man.
I just remember Madonna sang it. Well, I guess while we're on it, did you have an opinion on the Sam Smith theme for the song for Spectre?
I thought it was pretty solid.
It was okay. This is not a bad song. I thought the animation, like the, you know...
Really off-putting.
Really weird. Not okay with it.
Yeah, it was... I can't be the only one who thought that looked like hentai porn, right?
Yeah, like, that's definitely what was happening. Like,
and I... Like, it just felt, like, very uncomfortable watching it.
Yeah.
Because the opening credits are, like... You know, the general Bond thing where there's, like, a bunch of, like, silhouetted naked ladies.
Yeah.
But there's a bunch of tentacles.
Just wrapped around
just
all the
wrapped
girls.
Around all of them because of the Spectre logo.
Right. It's not...
Like...
It's weird. It's uncomfortable.
Somebody had to have said something at some point. Like, this...
Yeah. Yeah. But also, another. I mean, one of the reviews I read, and I can't remember where, if it was The Atlantic, maybe, I think... just said that this film kind of feels like a checking off of boxes of Bond things. Like, we're just waiting. We're just waiting for him to order a martini, shake and not stirred. We're just waiting, like, you know, waiting for all these things.
Yeah,
I do get that. And but even the opening credits felt like that for me. I mean, the opening credits felt like that more for me than the rest of the movie, where it's like,
really?
Okay. James Bond is going to fire a gun and the screen's going to shatter. There's going to be a girl falling and then bullets. Just like weird things like that. I don't know. That was the weird thing. But I do like this movie. We talked about it when we came out of the theater too. That it kind of sets up, it connects the world that never happens in Bond movies other than Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace.
Right. Yeah. So Quantum of Solace picks up right where Casino Royale leaves off.
Yeah.
And then Skyfall was kind of a departure from both of those. Like, it doesn't really have anything to do with either of those movies.
Right.
And this movie, Spectre, takes all three of those movies and kind of unites them all under this umbrella of Spectre.
Yeah.
And I think it does that in a really solid way. Like, it's not something that you definitely needed.
No.
But it's kind of neat.
Yeah, I kind of liked it. It also is kind of the Marvelization of cinema now. Like,
that's
everything has got to be connected.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, but I think it works
wasn't
pretty well.
It wasn't to the film's detriment.
And it makes me, like, it made me, you know, I was, like, considering, like, I saw a reference to Vesper Lynd, who is the lead girl in Casino Royale, and I was like, wow, oh man, I haven't heard her name in a long time.
Yeah.
And then they mentioned Quantum, and I was like, wow, okay. And it actually, like, I hated Quantum of Solace.
Right.
Like, I hated that movie. I had not seen that since it was in theaters. I might give it another shot at some point, but I hated that movie when it came out. And,
I think it's a bad Bond movie, but it's an okay action movie, so I kind of give it a little bit of a pass.
Okay. But...
Think of that while you're watching it.
Yeah, all right. I mean, Quantum of Solace for me, like, that movie was made during the writer's strike, and they basically made that movie without a script, and that...
Right.
Like, it messes it up for me big time. But
okay.
But this movie made me care about Quantum of Solace a little bit more.
Yeah.
Because now I, like, can understand, like, other stuff that happened in Quantum of Solace was, like, connected to stuff here. And so, like, even though I hadn't seen Quantum of Solace since 2008,
right.
You know, I was finding myself, remembering things that had happened in Quantum Solace because this movie kind of refreshed my memory and was like, oh, this is part of this thing. Like, all
right.
Like,
right. Yeah, I'll let it go.
Like, it's a retcon. It doesn't, like, it's not something that was in the plan when Quantum Solace was made.
No.
But, like, it works, I think.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't, it's not out of nowhere, like, yeah. to fix that. But it was cool. It the whole thing, I think, that made Skyfall so great, or at least for me, was the, like, kind of inclusion of the old movies in this new rough-and-tumble Daniel Craig franchise.
Right.
You know, with all the references with the Aston Martin is back, the, like, all that, you know,
right.
the ejector seat and all yes. that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I think this movie, it feels the most, like, classic James Bond movie.
Yes.
Out but of all of Daniel Craig's movies.
Yeah, it does. But I think that people saw that already in Skyfall, because that stuff happens in Spectre also.
Right. Skyfall, I think, does something really interesting, which is it kind of makes a statement about James Bond movies.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it takes what Craig has done so far with his two, with Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace, takes this, like, real-world, you know, kind of take on the Bond films, and is reverential towards movies past, but is also very, like, it looks toward the future.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of creates the status quo where, like, anything could really happen.
Yeah.
And Skyfall feels like a very complete arc, like, as one movie. Like, it's a standalone film. You don't need to see any other James Bond movies to enjoy Skyfall. Spectre might lose something if you hadn't seen the other three Craig Bond movies.
Right.
At least.
Yeah, that's definitely true. But I still enjoyed it. It's still fun. I don't know.
Yeah, as a Bond movie, I think it works really well. And, you know, it feels like, to me, like, I really enjoyed Spectre. It feels to me like the kind of Bond movie where you could watch it on, like, TNT.
Yeah. Like, right.
And not miss too much. Like,
yeah, on AMC's Bond Marathon.
Yeah, on AMC's Bond Marathon or something.
Whatever,
like.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something I can't really say for the other Craig Bond movies, except for maybe Skyfall.
Except for Skyfall, yeah.
You know, because the Bond movies follow a formula, and this movie follows that formula as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Skyfall kind of revitalized that formula and did something really interesting with it. And this movie doesn't really do what Skyfall did. It's kind of content to just be a James Bond movie.
Be a Bond movie, yeah. Right? I would agree with that, yeah.
And I think your enjoyment of this movie is kind of dependent on how much you like James Bond movies.
Right. That's a good point. Yeah, Skyfall was definitely a more universal appeal.
Yeah.
And this is much more of a Bond movie. You're right.
So, but again, I think it does feel like a classic Bond. Like, it seems like it does a really good job of mixing Daniel Craig's world with the world of, say, like, Roger Moore. You know? Like,
it's, yes. Yeah.
You know, it the action gets a little sillier. There's some gadgets. There's an unstoppable henchman.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even the whole Mexico City thing, kind of the Dia de los Muertos, kind of reminded me of Live and Let Die, like the voodoo movie.
Okay, yeah.
You know,
the really racist one.
Yeah, the really racist one, but not because of that. But like the guy that he's following is in an all white suit with a white top hat, and a skeleton mask. Like, it's very reminiscent of that kind of movie, like some scenes in Live and Let Die.
Yeah, I did want to mention the Mexico City scene, the opening scene, because I think it's like probably the best scene in the movie.
Yeah,
it's really like it opens with this great one take.
Shot. That was awesome.
Yeah, like the tracking really shot cool. That just follows Bond and this girl into the hotel room, and then him out the window and like going to set up. Like it looks great. Like
looks really cool.
And this movie, in addition to Skyfall, I think are the two best looking Bond movies like ever made. And Skyfall was shot by Roger Deakins, who is probably one of my favorites, like my favorite cinematographer. He does a lot of the Coen Brothers movies and a lot of other stuff. This movie was shot by Hoyt Van Hoytema, who is the guy who shot Interstellar.
Oh wow! Okay.
He also shot Let the Right One In and Her and The Fighter. So he does a great job here too. Like,
yeah,
he picks up the torch that Roger Deakins left and runs with it. Like, he does a lot of great shots.
One of the coolest, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to say give it a big thing, big title or whatever, but the fight scene in Skyfall when they're backlit by the advertisement on the building across
the,
that's like one of the coolest things ever.
Yeah.
And Spectre doesn't have anything quite like that, but that tracking shot in the beginning is really
awesome. It's pretty stellar, yeah.
Yeah.
But the action here is a lot of fun, though. Look, there's a lot of really great action scenes. I'm a big fan of the car chase. Batista's henchman, Mr. Hinks, is chasing Bond throughout the streets of, where were they, in Rome?
Yeah, that's in Rome, yeah.
Okay, yeah. It feels very, like, classic Bond, what I'm saying, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I liked, too, I forgot that Batista was, like, a thing gonna be, because I remember when they announced that there was, like, a casting call for a, odd job type Bond henchman.
Yeah.
I remember seeing that, and I, like, forgot all about that, and then saw David Batista's name in the opening credits, and I was like, oh, shit.
What?
Yeah, I forgot. So, I mean, I liked his character.
Yeah, I feel like he could have been in more of it.
Yeah, he was kind of, like, useless. Like, he did his odd job thing once. Like,
yeah, I feel like there's a point in the movie where he kind of disappears, and I won't say what it is because it's spoilers, but there's a point in the movie where he kind of disappears, and I kept expecting for him to come back.
Yeah.
And he never did. You know?
Yeah, that's true. I forgot about that. You're right.
So that's a little disappointing. I think... you know, he could potentially come back in another movie. You never know.
Yeah. Presumably. Yeah. Well, I guess maybe I'll save that.
What did you think of Christoph Waltz as the villain, as Franz Oberhauser?
He is... I said it when we came out of the theater. He's the only person born to be a Bond villain.
Yeah. And I think he's really solid here. I don't think he's as good as Javier Bardem in Skyfall is.
No, that's true.
But he's very good. And yeah, he's the guy who is like... As soon as they cast Christoph Waltz, it was like, all right. Like, I know exactly what performance we're getting. Like,
yeah, he's an amazing actor with a German accent. Like, he's got to be a Bond villain.
Yeah, so he was very good. And, you know, the rest of this cast is very good, too. I'm a big fan of how Skyfall and Spectre have integrated M, Q, and Moneypenny into the action. You know, they're a main part of the narrative. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really cool, because a lot of the time, they're not. Like...
they're mostly just there to be the joke at the beginning of the movie and set up the rest of it, and that's it.
Pretty much.
But now they're actually part of, like, the main cast and stuff.
Yeah, look, they're great, and Naomi Harris is great as Moneypenny. I was actually, like, looking up Naomi Harris, because I didn't realize that I knew her from a bunch of things.
Yeah, to me, she's that girl from 28 Days Later.
That's what it was, like, she's 28 Days Later. She's also the voodoo priestess in Pirates of the Caribbean 2 and 3.
What? Oh my god, I never noticed that.
So that's weird. Like,
yeah, that's awesome. I didn't know that was her. But yeah, every time I see her, I'm like, oh, it's the girl from 28 Days Later.
Yeah, and I think Ben Whishaw is great as Q. Like, I'm a big fan of him.
Oh my god.
Ralph Fiennes is great taking over as M. Mm-hmm. You know, he was in Skyfall as, you know, M's like number two, but then M died at the end of Skyfall. Judi Dench is M. Died at the end of Skyfall, and so Ralph Fiennes is like in her role now, and he's doing a great job. I'm a big fan of Ralph Fiennes as well.
Yeah, he's great. I liked I don't know his name, but Moriarty from Sherlock as C or whatever the
Okay, I don't watch Sherlock, so I had no idea that.
That's fine. Yeah, he's awesome. He's a great actor on Sherlock, and I was excited to see him in a bigger role.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Very cool.
What about the gadgets?
Okay. Yeah. There are some cool gadgets.
That's the Bond thing.
That is the Bond thing. And that's something that the Craig movies have kind of avoided. For the most part, I think Skyfall might've had
and Skyfall even made fun of them.
Yeah. Skyfall.
What are you expecting? Exploding pen.
Yeah. The best gadget that Bond has had so far was in Skyfall where, he has a gun that can only shoot in his hand or something like that.
Yeah. The handprint scanner thing or whatever.
Which is fine, but it's not like, you know.
That's not a Bond gadget.
It's not a Bond gadget. In this movie, there's at least a few. There's it doesn't go as crazy as, Invisible Car.
Invisible Cars,
but, there's a car that's bulletproof and has a bunch of, weapons and that,
And an ejector seat.
And an ejector seat. There's an exploding watch.
Yep. That's a classic Bond.
Yeah. So, you know, there's some cool stuff here. And, again, maybe it is just checking off the Bond boxes.
Right.
Those boxes are fun.
But they're cool. Yeah, they're cool. I liked it. I mean, the Nano Blood is a new...
That's true.
Is a new Bond gadget, quote-unquote, I guess.
Yeah.
But it does, there is that, I don't know, is, the next Bond movie, going to also be about, like, secret agents are a thing of the past, and we got to fight for our right to be secret agents.
I mean, Skyfall was also that, right?
Like, that's what I mean, yeah. Is the next one also going
to
be that?
I feel like it's very difficult to make a Bond. That's the thing. I feel like it's very difficult
to justify a Bond movie.
Yeah, because Bond was such a relic of the Cold War. Like, that was the thing. And once the Cold War ended, it seems like every Bond movie since GoldenEye has been about, like, well, Bond's a relic of the past.
Yeah, that's a good, oh my god, right? I never even thought of that. Yeah, you're right.
You know, like, why do we need secret agents? And it's actually kind of funny, because this movie has a very similar subplot as Mission Impossible Rogue Nation.
It does,
which is all about, you know, somebody trying to shut down the IMF. This is somebody trying to shut down the 007 program.
Yeah.
Or the
00
program.
And fighting the shadow government thing.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and so it's weird, because James Bond is sort of like a franchise at odds with itself. Like, it's constantly fighting with itself to figure out why James Bond exists.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But I think we've talked about all of that a lot. We should get into some story stuff, because there's certain things about the story that, you know, are deserve discussion. So let's move on to spoilers for Spectre. All right, we are getting to spoilers for Spectre starting right now. Christoph Waltz is Blofeld.
Oh, who didn't see that coming?
Dun, dun, dun. what did you think of this reveal, Mike? I mean, do you think it works in the context of the movie that Christoph Waltz is Blofeld?
Yeah, I think it works. I think so.
Okay, yeah, I actually, I've seen a lot of people criticize this part of the movie. And here's the thing. I never thought for a second that Christoph Waltz was not playing Blofeld.
Right.
Like, as soon as he was announced in the role, as soon as he was announced as the villain of the movie, in a movie called Spectre.
Right. Like, it's gotta be.
Like, there was no way that he was not playing Blofeld. And everybody involved in the movie,
it's like, no.
Bent over backwards, like, no, he's not playing Blofeld. He's playing Franz Oberhauser.
Yeah.
Wink. Yeah, exactly. And it was very similar to the production of Star Trek Into Darkness, where Benedict Cumberbatch was playing Khan, but his character's name was John Harrison. And everybody was making a big deal about how he's not playing Khan, he's playing John Harrison.
Yeah.
And so I've seen a lot of people criticize this movie for that and compare it to Star Trek Into Darkness in that way. I do think it's very similar, but I think it's handled a lot better in this movie than in Star Trek Into Darkness.
Yeah, we discussed that.
Yeah, in Star Trek Into Darkness, there's a scene, like, Benedict Cumberbatch is in a little bit of the movie, he's talking, and there's a scene where he's trapped by Kirk in, like, this glass case.
Yeah.
It's been a while since I've seen it. That movie was kind of dumb. and he's, you know, talking to Kirk, and he's just like, no, don't you know who I am? Or, like, something along those lines. Like, and he says, like, my name is Khan. Like, really dramatically and, like, really, like, over the top. And Kirk has no reaction to this.
Right, because he doesn't know who Khan is.
Because, like, he doesn't know who Khan is.
Yeah.
And so it's played like this big reveal that, like, should be this huge thing for everybody involved. And it's not. Like,
right.
Like, right. Nobody knows who Khan is except for the Star Trek fans in the audience, and everybody who was a fan of the audience groaned, because that's I remember being there, and everybody was like, come on, like, like, you could just say his name was Khan at the beginning of the movie and it would have been fine.
It'd be okay.
We would have believed you. And so this movie has a very similar scene. He's been Franz Oberhauser for, you know, a good chunk of the movie, and then reveals that he's taken the name Blofeld, which is his mother's maiden name.
Right.
You know, because his father's name caused him too much pain. And it's not this grand reveal. It's just this, like, him saying it to Bond, like, oh, no, Franz Oberhauser is dead. My name is Blofeld.
Yeah. And it's cool, because it's, like, really understated, and he's just explaining what his name is now.
Yeah, like, it's not that big of a deal. And, like, the only reason they do it is to have people go, like, oh, wow, Blofeld, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And so I do think it's unnecessary. I think they could have just started the movie with him saying he's Blofeld, and it would have been fine.
Right. But it's not, it doesn't take, it's not like a, like in Star Trek, where it's like a groan-worthy scene.
Yeah, it's not like this big reveal that's supposed to mean something to the characters. Or to the audience. This is like, it's supposed to be like a little wink to the, like, it's supposed to mean something to the audience that'll know Blofeld from the various Bond films of the Sean Connery era.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, and that's just, I think, is another Daniel Craig era, like, reference to the old movies, which is why they did that, I think.
Right. Exactly,
instead of just having him be Blofeld at the start.
Right. I think this is, like, sort of building to him being Blofeld. Because the thing is, right. He does not die at the end of this movie. And I think Daniel Craig will probably be back for one more. A lot of people were saying he won't be. I think he will be. Mm-hmm. And if he is, Christoph Waltz will be back as Blofeld, I would say.
Yeah, I think he's going to be Blofeld for a while, at least. Or at least the next movie.
That'd be kind of cool if he would come back every once in a while and just be Blofeld in a Bond movie.
That'd be awesome. That'd be great.
So there's that. And there's the whole thing with Bond and Blofeld's shared past in this movie, which hasn't really been a thing before. But so in Skyfall, it was established that Bond's parents died when he was a kid.
Right.
And in this movie, it's established that Bond was raised by Franz Oberhauser's dad for like 2 years, and then the dad died.
Right.
And to me, this didn't really work.
Yeah, it kind of sets up Blofeld as just like a jealous child.
Sort of. And it also kind of comes completely out of nowhere. Like, at the beginning of the movie, Bond sees Franz Oberhauser at the Spectre meeting, right? And there's no moment where he, like, at the beginning of the meeting, there's the part of the meeting where he's like, I see you, James.
Yeah.
You're right there. But, like, there's no moment where Bond registers the fact that he knows who Franz Oberhauser is.
Yeah, although I do think when Oberhauser, at that point, like, starts that whole, like, James, I see you, like, that whole thing in the meeting, he looks terrified. Bond looks terrified. And I think that is some kind of recognition that he knows who that is.
Sure.
But there is no, like, explicit or
there's no direct, like, there's no point where he mentions to somebody, like, I know who this guy is.
Right. Yeah.
And the thing is, he's been looking for Franz Oberhauser for a while up to this point, right? Or no, this is actually before, never mind. He discovers who Franz Oberhauser is after this meeting.
Right? Yeah.
He starts looking for him.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's not enough there to, you know, convey to the audience that they have a shared history until, like, that happens towards the end, to, like, when they get to Blofeld's
compound or whatever.
Compound, like, in a crater.
Which is awesome.
Like, that's classic Bond villain location right there.
In the middle of a desert in a crater.
Yep. So there's that. I mean, what did you think of Lea Seydoux as Mr. White's daughter?
Like, she was cool, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I did think Mr. White was a character in Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace, so I thought it was cool that they brought him back.
Yeah, and I couldn't remember what movie he was from.
Yeah, he was in both. He's the guy at the end of Casino Royale that Bond, like, corners and, like, shoots.
Oh, yeah, right.
After Vesper Lynd's death.
Right.
So I thought it was cool they brought him back. I thought his scene was really good.
Yeah, he was awesome.
And, you know, I feel like more could have been done with Lea Seydoux's character.
Mm-hmm. She's kind of established. We get that scene on the train when he's trying to show her how to use a gun. Like, she, you know, we find out she has a dark past.
Right. Like, she's, like,
she shot somebody, we're assuming.
Yeah, she can shoot. She knows how to hand-to-hand combat and stuff. She's set up as this more proactive version of a Bond girl. Mm-hmm.
And then gets immediately knocked out when Batista is like, that really bothered me. It was like, we established that she can handle herself, and then, poof, done, you're out, see you later. Yeah.
And then she does come back.
She does come back and save the day.
Batista or something.
Yeah.
But I feel like the more could have been done with her because she mostly just gets kidnapped throughout the movie.
That's what I mean, yeah. Like, don't have that scene of her being like, I can handle myself. Unless it's, I don't know. And then, like, just don't use her at all. Like, make her an awesome Bond person. I don't know.
Yeah. I also think the romance between her and Bond felt very rushed.
Yeah. As far as we know, I think the timeline of the movie is they've known each other 3 days and then they love each other. Like, I don't really know.
Like, there's the scene right after Batista is right after the big train scene with Batista, and Batista falls off the train. You know, there's a scene where she's like, so what do we do now? And they immediately cut to them having sex.
Smash cut to them on the bed.
Yeah, which was great. I thought that was pretty funny.
That was pretty funny.
And it was like, yeah, that's classic Bond. But then, like, they're at the compound and she says something like, I love you. And it's like, what?
It doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
Like, already? That was fast.
That was quick. Yeah, that's the end. Like, he loves her back, apparently.
Yeah. the movie ends with them riding off into the sunset.
It ends with, like, we'll put the lost dog between us and see which one it picks. Like, that's what the movie ends on. Which was a little underwhelming.
Yeah, it's a bit much. I think the idea was that it was supposed to echo the ending of Casino Royale, but without the tragic death of Vesper Lynd.
Right.
Because that was the ending of Casino Royale. Like, The last 20 minutes.
I don't remember
of
the end of Casino Royale.
Yeah, he was. What?
I don't remember the ending of it. What? Refresh my memory.
The ending of Casino Royale is Bond. I think he marries Vesper Lynd, or they like leave to go live their life together, and then Vesper Lynd is killed.
Right.
And
then he has to need to get a Quantum of Solace.
Yeah, and that leads into Quantum of Solace. So I think this was the idea of this was to kind of echo that ending, but without the tragedy of the death of the Bond girl.
Makes sense. There you go.
So I think that ultimately works, and again, that's sort of a nice kind of way to tie all the movies together again. If this was Daniel Craig's final movie as James Bond, which I think it was kind of set up sort of like that.
It's possible that it could be, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a nice kind of like full circle kind of way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. The way to getting there feels very rushed and like underdeveloped to me, their romance.
Mm-hmm. That was pretty awkward how like all of a sudden they're in love. So was the train scene when Bautista gets pulled off, was that the last time we see him?
Yeah.
That is, right?
That is. Okay. And I, you know, you can presume that he maybe died, but also, like, you don't see him die.
Right, we don't see him die. And he's a Bond villain.
And he's a Bond villain, and we've seen him take, like, pretty big beatings at this point. So, like,
yeah,
it's, you know, quite possible that he's still alive. And I kept thinking, like, it'd be kind of cool if Batista showed up again. Like,
yeah.
throughout, like, during the big climax or something. But,
he
never shows up again.
Yeah, I think him and Blofeld will be back.
Hopefully. Yeah, I think a future Bond film, the fifth, and I think if Craig makes another movie, that will be his last one.
Yeah.
I feel like five is a great run.
Yeah.
For him. You know, I feel like one last movie with Blofeld and Batista, and I guess Léa Seydoux.
I guess, yeah.
You know, I feel like I could write some of the mistakes of this movie while doing what works. You know, this has, it, like a lot, like I feel like we've kind of torn down a lot of the parts of this movie, but
yeah.
Without really meaning to, because we both pretty much very much enjoyed this movie.
I still enjoyed it. Yeah, it was still good.
You know, as Bond movies go, this is very solid. I think it's up there. And Daniel Craig is my favorite Bond, so I do want to see him do one more movie.
Do one final, one last trilogy.
One last trilogy.
That joke will never get old.
Yeah, although that's a recurring joke now.
Yeah.
So in any case, I think we both liked Spectre, I think is what we're trying to say. Even though it is a flawed film, it's not nearly
there as are good. Some issues, but
not nearly as good as Skyfall or Casino Royale. It did make me want to rewatch all of the Craig Bond movies, which you know, is a testament to this franchise and I think how much I like it. I was actually when I was revisiting some of the Bond themes, I was watching the opening credit sequences. Do you remember how amazing the opening credits of Casino Royale are?
Only that's the black and white one, right?
No, it's
or is that Quantum of Solace?
Quantum of Solace might be black and white. The opening credits of Casino Royale, like, are I mean, they have
the parkour chase thing, right?
No, that's the opening scene. I'm talking about the. I mean, that is awesome too.
Yeah,
but I'm talking about the actual like opening theme, like Chris.
Cornell's, the actual theme.
Yeah,
oh.
Chris Cornell's "You Know My Name" with the imagery. It's like all this like poker Las Vegas stuff, and it looks awesome. Like it's so like distinctive and like different than a lot of other James Bond stuff.
Yeah,
and it's really cool. I was just thinking, like, I was revisiting that, and being like, wow, this is really cool. I should watch Casino Royale again soon.
Yeah. I just saw on Reddit somebody posted all 24 of the gun barrel shots synced together. Like it's like just a big montage of all of them at once, and it's really awesome. It's really nice. Cool. And I think, I can't remember, I think it's Casino Royale. It's the one that opens, like, when he gets his first kill, or second kill, I guess, because you have to get, that's how you get 00.
Maybe, yeah, that's
what I don't remember. Yeah, it's really cool.
Casino Royale is when he gets his license to kill.
Yeah, right. It's that, and it has that's part of the gun barrel thing, so it's like, it was in there, in that scene. In that gif, I mean. Oh, whatever, the internet stuff happened. And it was cool. Go see Bond movies.
Yes, yeah. Bond movies, a lot of fun. Spectre, a lot of fun. As far as the Daniel Craig movies go, I would probably say Casino Royale is the best, and then Skyfall, and then Spectre, and then...
Wow, bold move.
And then several notches, and then Quantum of Solace.
And like, Quantum of Solace. And then GoldenEye, and then Tomorrow Never Dies, and then Quantum of Solace. Pierce Brosnan movies are better than Quantum of Solace.
Yeah, GoldenEye and Tomorrow Never Dies is pretty... GoldenEye is great.
GoldenEye
is awesome. Big fan of GoldenEye. Tomorrow Never Dies is also very good, I think.
Yeah, I love Tomorrow Never Dies. I think that was the first... No, I think World's Not Enough, actually, is the first Bond movie I saw in theaters.
Really?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, I think mine was Casino Royale, actually.
Oh, there you go.
So, yeah, Craig is my Bond. It's like...
Nailed it.
All right. So, Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog.
And you can find me at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog, as well as all of my podcasts at filmbook.com. My podcast is about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Gotham and Arrow. And you can find our other podcasts at filmbook.com also, The Complete Works, which is our complete rundown of the entire filmography of Nicolas Cage.
If we ever catch up.
Yeah. For every movie that we review, he makes two more.
Yeah.
It's like Hydra.
It's exactly like Hydra.
Thank you for listening to Film Bookcast. If you're listening to this review of our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to our podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email. We produce so many different ones, it's hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us next week for the next episode of The Complete Works, where Mike and I will be discussing Nicolas Cage's role in the Coen brothers' Raising Arizona, which is another movie that Mike's embarrassed to have never seen before.
Yes, yeah. So it's a week of firsts for me.
Exactly. It's a big week. It's a big week for you.
Yeah.
And check out the next Film Bookcast in 2 weeks, where Mike and I will probably be reviewing the big finale to the Hunger Games movies, yes. Mockingjay Part 2. You excited for that one, Mike?
Yeah, I'm excited. Those are good movies, but I've mentioned it before when we've been talking that I forgot that these are a thing. I feel like waiting. I think they filmed these back to back.
I think so. They released them about a year apart. I always forget that Hunger Games movie is coming out until it's a week beforehand.
Yeah, I feel like waiting a whole year to release part two of this was too long.
I don't know. I mean, it's things I really liked part one, Mockingjay Part One.
I did like Mockingjay Part
One. I thought that was easily the best one.
Yeah,
to me. So, you know, I'm eager to see Mockingjay Part 2. I might not remember everything that happened in Part 1, but...
yeah, I just don't care anymore.
We'll see. Yeah, it's
that's weird. What I mean. My excitement's out for this.
It's such
franchise.
A weird franchise because I feel like I've been enjoying it more and more with each movie, and yet every time I see it, I'm like, all right.
Whatever, I guess. And then turns out it's a good movie.
Yeah, I feel like I should give it the benefit of the doubt at this point, and...
yeah.
I just
let it happen.
I'm just not that excited about it, but I do kind of want to see it, and it's a big finale, so definitely gonna check that out. All right, guys, thank you so much for listening. We are out.
He's got a gun, great big man tits. He's got jug ears and tiny trunks. Then Judy Dench is furious with him. He's gone completely out to lunch. The quantum of the quantum.